Morning, everybody, and welcome to this session. I mean, I was going to wait for two or three more minutes to see if anybody else was going to turn up. But I think, as most of us are all here, we might as well start now. We're allowed apparently 2 hours, but I don't think Steve is going to speak for 2 hours. But the theme of the talk and the discussion is the utopian tradition. So I'll hand over to Steve.
Thank you, Comrade Chairman, comrades and friends. We live in history. By that I mean that history is in a constant state of motion. Nothing is, everything is becoming. The present is merely a transient moment on the spectrum of change. No sooner do we reflect upon the present than we're recalling the past. No sooner do we act within the present than we're entering the future. And the future is not something out there. The future is made by men and women out of the material building blocks inherited from our collective past. We can make more of the same. We can make something different. What we make of the future is a political choice. History is, in a sense, a record of those choices. And that's why the concept of utopianism is so important to a creative understanding of history. The dogmatists and dullards insist that where we are is where we have to be. In slave society, they asserted that slaves shall always be slaves. In feudal society, they asserted that peasants must forever be peasants. Under capitalism, they hold tight to the certainty that wage slaves forevermore will be wage slaves, that markets are inevitable, that money is the only way of accessing goods and services, that history came to an end with the building of banks, stock exchanges, and supermarkets. Now, those of us who reject this historical rigor mortis are deemed to be utopians because we are looking beyond the cracks in the edifice of capitalism. As deviants who dare to conceive of a different trajectory for history. But the past is littered with the certainties of those who have faced reality and lost the plot of history. One of the lessons of history, for which there is perhaps more evidence than most other lessons of history, is that those who imagine that things will never change are always proved wrong. At the heart of this pernicious ideological error about change lies a set of beliefs about what it means to be human, to have what they call human nature, as if those of us who seek a different future are somehow trying to deal in something inhuman. To seek to transcend this human nature is regarded as the worst kind of utopianism. So what is this nature of human beings that we are so foolish to dare to oppose? I think it takes four forms. First of all, there's man, the sinner. As Saint Augustine, the great theorist of Christian ideology, made clear, I quote, "God, the author of all our natures, but not of their defects, created man good. But man, corrupt by choice and condemned by justice, has produced a progeny that is both corrupt and condemned." So God creates man good, man has created this sin, this defective personality, which is going to infect the entire progeny of human beings. There is no cure. Calvin, the Protestant thinker, wrote, "There is more worth in all the vermin of the world than there is in man, for he is a creature in whom the image of God has been effaced." And that's clear. You know where you stand with that view of human nature. Then you get man the warrior. After man the sinner, there's man the warrior. for Thomas Hobbes, this war is not a historical contingency. It's an inevitable competition running through all of human society. He writes, I quote, "Men are continually in competition for honour and dignity. And consequently, amongst men, there arises envy and hatred and finally war." So this human nature is not just something that is infectious, incurable and nasty. It is something that leads to people killing each other. As Hobbes says, again, I quote, "Men from their very birth and naturally scramble for everything they covet and would have all the world, if they could, to fear and obey them." And so after man the sinner and man the warrior, you get man the predator. With the rise of Darwinism and with the birth in the 19th century of sociology. And Herbert Spencer, the father of sociology, invented the notion of the survival of the fittest. The idea that human beings survive by means of a cruel and incessant struggle in which nature is read in tooth and claw. Everybody is subjected to this. And after man the sinner, man the warrior, man the predator, we have man the eternal egotist, aggressively going out and furthering his own ego in competition with every other ego. As Freud puts it in Civilization and Its Discontents, his most philosophical work about human beings and his most miserable, he says, I quote, "Men are not gentle creatures who want to be loved and who are at the most can defend themselves if they are attacked. They are, on the contrary, creatures amongst whom whose instinctual endowments is to be reckoned a powerful share of aggressiveness. As a result, their neighbour is for them not only a potential helper or sexual object, but also someone who tempts them to satisfy their aggressiveness on him, to exploit his capacity for work without compensation, to use him sexually without his consent, to seize his possessions, to humiliate him, to cause him pain, to torture and to kill him." This is Freud. And there is no cure. This is the view of human nature, which cumulatively is summed up when people use that phrase that one hears so often. It's only human nature. It's only human nature. But if you were to say, well, she's only a woman, or, well, it's only a black, or, well, it's only an American. But actually, if you say this about the entire human species, this is not considered offensive. It's considered eminently reasonable. Human beings are inevitably cursed into this position. Now, the utopian position has been pitted against this historical pessimism, this dire negative view of humankind. And there are three types of argument that have constituted the utopian tradition, three types of position which has stood against this human nature argument. The first I'll define as being the fantasy of human perfection, a sort of natural state of human goodness. Secondly, there's the ideal of remodeling human behavior. The idea that if you present people with enough of a stimulus to behave well, they behave well. And thirdly, the utopian libertarian position. The view that essentially you create an environment that provides outlets for every kind of behavior, and that in itself constitutes utopia. Three positions to look at. First of all, then, the fantasy of human perfection. And this has persisted throughout the history of oppression as people have looked up from their conditions of misery and toil and struggle and frustration and bitterness. And they said, what else is there? What could it be like? Let's imagine. Pagan literature, that is to say, pre-Christian literature, is filled with such moments of utopian vision of the earth unburdened. In the early 7th century BC, Hesiod's Works and Days spoke of the return of the mythical golden age of Chronos, when men, quote, lived as if they were gods, their hearts free from all sorrow and without hard work or pain. The fruitful earth yielded its abundant harvest to them of its own accord, and they lived in ease and peace upon their lands with many good things. Virgil wrote similarly of the abundant age of the return of Saturn, and in book one of Ovid's Metamorphoses, we're offered this glowing description of the world as it could be, a golden age, but a recoverable golden age. I quote, "Golden was that first age, with no one to compel, without a law of its own will, kept faith and did the right. There was no need at all of armed men, for nations, secure from war's alarms, passed the years in gentle ease. The earth herself, without compulsion, untouched by hoe or ploughshare, of herself gave all things needful. The spring was everlasting, and gentle zephyrs and warm breath played with the flowers that sprung unplanted. Anon the earth, untilled, brought forth her store of grains, and the fields, though unfallowed, grew white with a heavy bearded wheat. Streams of wheat and streams of sweet nectar flowed, and yellow honey was distilled from the verdant oak." I mean, it's actually a very touching, a rather beautiful view of an age that has slipped away, slipped into something that is lost but retrievable. And in the Middle Ages, where this utopian aspiration was frowned upon and declared to be a heresy, in which the notion of sin and unrecoverable sin was so prevalent, there were, in fact, a number of very interesting writers who started to think and to describe utopian alternatives. St. Brendan, in the 6th century, wrote about an island to the west of his native island, which, as come to be imagined as America, in which he says there is an ever-present gentle summer, providing a ready supply of fruits. And he then talks about how there is a supply of all good things, but what is more, their will is done in all things. The people of this island are able to exercise their own will. And so this fantasy of human perfection, of a world in which something which meant something about goodness and cooperation prevailed, was to come into the literature of common people in the Middle Ages. And in the 14th century, that folk poem, The Land of Cocaine, in which the geese flew around, ready roasted, flying out, "Geese, all hot, all hot," and even asking you if you wanted a particular sauce on them. This was something which, in a sense, reflected that kind of mood. "Every man takes what he will as of right to eat his fill. All is common to young and old, to stout and strong, to meek and bold." And that has persisted to the present day through songs like the Norwegian utopian folk song, the Big Rock Candy Mountain, where and Lennon's Imagine. This tradition of hope. But in many respects, it's hope grounded purely in fantasy, in imagination, but not in any sense in a capacity to retrieve this lost past, these great ethical aspirations. Secondly, the utopian tradition of remodeling humanity, of making humans better. Now, I think that the root of this is to be found not in the 19th century utopians like Robert Owen, but in the people who formed Owen's thoughts, and in fact have a tremendously important role in informing socialist thought, the 17th century behaviorists, the first of whom was John Locke, who in his Thoughts Concerning Education, published in 1693, made the radical claim that
of all the men we meet, with 9 parts of 10, are what they are, good or evil, useful or not, by their education. It is that which makes a great difference in mankind. And he, in his argument that it is education that makes people what they are, it's how you're formed, it's how you're brought up, it's how you're responded to as a child, it's how you learn to read and write, how you learn to respond to other people. This argument that that's what you do with the blank sheet of childhood is developed in the 18th century, particularly in David Hartley's Observations on Man, in which he argues, I quote, "If beings of the same species, but whose affections and passions are at present in different proportions to each other, be exposed for an indefinite time to the same impressions and associations, all their particular differences will at last be overruled, and they will become perfectly similar or even equal. They may also be made perfectly similar in a finite time by a proper adjustment of the impressions and associations." So in a sense, the argument is that you can create an environment, you can create ways of associating, ways of conditioning people that will make them equal, that will make them share qualities, that will make them develop in the same way. And Robert Owen, in his important Essays on the Formation of Character in 1813, was essentially taking this line of reasoning further with the added perspective that he said, let's try to experiment with this theory. Let's see what happens if you do put people in equal conditions, if you create an environment in which they are not artificially discriminated against, impoverished, and frustrated in their lives. So Owen begins his argument by exposing what he regards as a major error in all previous non-utopian thinking. He says, I quote, "From the earliest ages, it has been the practice of the world to act on the supposition that each individual man forms his own character, and that therefore he is accountable for all his sentiments and habits, and consequently merits reward for some and punishment for others. This is not a slight mistake which involves only trivial consequences. It is a fundamental error of the highest possible magnitude. It enters into all our proceedings regarding man from his infancy, and it will be found to be the true and sole origin of evil. It generates and perpetuates ignorance, hatred, and revenge, where without such error, only intelligence, confidence, and kindness would exist." Right? I actually think those opening sentences from Owen's writings are extremely powerful ones, because it seems that he put his finger here on something that is fundamentally correct, that it is not some sort of natural propensity, either of humans in general or of particular individual humans, to act antisocially, criminally, selfishly, but it is the way in which people are brought up, the environment in which they are grown. So Owen, in denying that humans take their characters, have their characters inherently there and can be blamed for them, then asks himself, what do you do about creating conditions in which there is an alternative? And what he argues is you have to set up a new model environment. And the new model environment that Owen began to set up in New Lanark in Scotland was a village based upon a factory, schools, and housing in which people were treated with relative dignity, with relative equality, although not complete equality, and certainly not equality with him, but certainly in which there were opportunities that were much more equal than in the rest of society. And particularly in relation to children. Children, he wrote, are without exception passive and wonderfully contrived compounds, which by an accurate previous and subsequent attention founded on a correct knowledge of the subject, may be formed collectively to have had any human character. That was his argument, that was his thesis, which he set out to test. Now, in New Lanark, two schools were established. One for children from 2 to 6, and the other from the ages of 6 to 12. Book learning and learning by rote was rejected in the New Lanark schools. Instead, the children were encouraged to develop their rational faculties in order to think of new ways to solve problems and to gain knowledge. The teachers in the New Lanark schools were specifically instructed by Owen that, and I quote, they were on no account ever to beat any of the children or to threaten them in any manner of word or action or to use abusive terms, unquote. The older children were actively encouraged to help the younger ones to learn and to find their way around the world. The schoolroom of New Lanark was created to avoid drabness. The walls were covered with paintings of the natural environment, and the children were encouraged in the schools to learn about subjects that interested them, not just an externally imposed curriculum. Now, Owen's schools also were based upon another significant principle, which was that children should not be taught to do one particular job or vocation in life, but that they should be taught to do many different things, and so as when they graduated from school, they could go out into the world and develop themselves in many ways. And what happened as a result of this? Well, when the inspectors came to visit the New Lanark school, they discovered that, and I quote, being always treated with kindness and confidence and altogether without fear, even of a harsh word from any of their numerous teachers, they exhibited an unaffected grace and natural politeness which surprised and fascinated everyone. So, to a very great extent, the New Lanark experience, at least in terms of this experiment of trying to take children in an uncoercive, free environment, resulted in something that was peculiarly successful and inspiring. I want to move now to a third model within the utopian tradition, which is associated with the French thinker Charles Fourier. He believed that all humans were born with innate instinctual drives, which he called the passions. And he wrote an enormously complex book listing each of these different 810 personality types that he thought people had. Now, for Fourier, the aim of utopia was essentially a libertarian arrangement in which each of these passions, each of these personality types, would be allowed freedom to do whatever they needed to do. Fourier wrote, I quote, one should never blame the passions of individuals, but rather the civilization which forces men to practice vice by offering the passions only vices for their satisfaction. So Fourier's utopianism is different from Owen's in that he's not trying to push people in to a model environment and create certain qualities which he has defined. He's arguing for a much more free-flowing utopia in which everybody has a chance to satisfy themselves. As he put it, happiness consists of having many passions and many means to satisfy them, unquote. But Fourier's experience, his experience was such that he didn't ever set up one of his model phalansteries, his communes in which all of these passions were going to be catered for. He spent most of his life trying to raise the money to set these things up, and of course he failed. He didn't get them. Well, I want to reflect upon these three models within a utopian tradition by suggesting that what we are seeing are models of utopianism that are fed in to other parts of contemporary politics. In the fantasy of human perfection, I think we're seeing some of the ideas that are fed in to a kind of rather amorphous and vague anarchism that has developed over the years, a notion that and all it will be all right on the night view of revolution, that essentially you leave people to develop, and what surrounds them is going to be a society of happiness and perfection. And whilst aspirationally socialists would support that, in fact it is probably no more realistic now than it was in the times of pagan literature, when people dreamed these wonderful dreams. And then I think that within the Owenite tradition, what we see is a precursor of the statism, the centralizing modeling of the environment, the will fix it for you approach, which whilst nobody, I think, should criticize Owen's paternalistic benevolence in that regard, and you might not want to criticize Lenin's paternalistic benevolence in his particular regard, the fact is it is statist, it is centralized, it is ultimately condescending and opposed to the kind of autonomy that runs through the socialist tradition. And then thirdly, Fourier's libertarianism perhaps has found its place within some of the fragmentation of the market that we've seen within capitalism since the 1960s, where you have what is called a more permissive society, but in fact a more varied market that will now cater for all kinds of passions, enthusiasms and peculiarities in every way except relieving people of their need to become exploited. In conclusion, then, I want to turn to the socialist vision of William Morris. Was Morris himself a utopian? Well, yes, he was, and no, he wasn't. Certainly, he spent a great deal of his energy painting pictures of an alternative future. He did so as a means of educating desire, of helping people to understand what they wanted, to want more, to want better, to want what was achievable. Certainly, the kind of humans that Morris wrote about, for example, in News from Nowhere, look and sound very much like utopians. I mean, he says in News from Nowhere, one of the people living in Nowhere is explaining to the guest, I quote, "We have been living for 150 years at least, more or less in our present manner, and a tradition or habit of life has been growing on us. And that habit has become a habit of acting on the whole for the best. It is easy for us to live without robbing each other. It would be possible for us to contend with and rob each other, but it would be harder for us to do that than refraining from strife and robbery. That is, in short, the foundation of our life and of our happiness." So, Nowhere has about it, with its permanent sunshine, its healthy people, its willing serving maids of whom we've spoken earlier, all of the kind of feel of a utopia, albeit a particular kind of utopia. But where Morris transcends the utopian tradition, and where contemporary socialists depart from mere utopian longings, is by locating the struggle for a different future within material history. So I return to my opening comment. We live in history. And when utopia lives in history, it is thereby enabled to become more than just utopia. It becomes a plan, a proposal, a means of moving from A to B. Morris's News from Nowhere was the first utopia ever to have a history. In short, it didn't just fall out of a benign sky or emerge as an island of contentment within an ocean of woe. Morris's socialist vision was of a system of society that emerged from another system of society. It was a system that came out of something different. Its history, like all history, was messy and contradictory and imbued with struggle between rival classes. The materialist conception of socialism transcends the utopian tradition and enters the realm of history. That is to say, the sphere of politics which connects where we are with where we could be. And for this change to move beyond the realm of fantasy, then an historical agency of change has to exist. As Marx put it in his first draft of the Civil War in France, I quote, from the moment when the working class movement becomes real, the fantastic utopias weaken. Not because the working class had given up the end aimed at by these utopians, but because they had found the real means to realize them, unquote. Now, I want to say as an aside, and it may well be a stimulus to some discussion, that I think there has been a tragic misunderstanding and a rather narrow interpretation of what Marx was saying here. Because what Marx said is not that socialists have nothing whatsoever to do with the utopian tradition, but in a sense that we found new ways of realizing it. We can do it in a more scientific fashion. But there has come to be a very strong and rather rigid leftist view which stifles imagination and opposes the kind of utopianism that can refresh and stimulate the socialist vision, which has neglected any kind of connection with that tradition. So Lenin, writing in 1912, was able to assert that, I quote, "Marxists are hostile to all and every utopia. In politics, utopia is a wish that can never come true, neither now nor in the future." Now, the trouble with that position is that politics becomes an endless cycle of reforming and reinventing what is. Politics, once you remove yourself from this tradition of thinking afresh, thinking differently, transcending the historical boundaries, always becomes a process of negotiating with existing realities, of reordering what is effectively the current social order. Thinking and planning for a future beyond what is becomes derided as being unrealistic, impossibilist, loony, utopian. Now, this is the mood of the political age that we're in right now. Never has capitalism looked or felt more obsolete and redundant. Everything about capitalism at the moment stinks of minority privilege holding back the majority from enjoying a secure, cooperative, and democratic future. And yet, more than at any time that at least I can remember, to challenge capitalism is dismissed as if one is challenging the law of gravity. It's dismissed as if there is a fundamental reality which cannot be argued with, challenged, questioned, transcended. So that's why we need a socialist vision now. We need it, first of all, to make sense of capitalism. We need it to explain the class conflict and to show that it doesn't need to exist. We need it to propose the replacement of production for profit by production solely for use. But we need it, perhaps, to do more than that. We need to show how society could be, how it could feel, what it could be like to wake up in the morning if men and women were free. We need to show what free men and women, unburdened by the yoke of economic exploitation and the omnipotence of property, could be like. We need to present a challenge to those who think that we've reached the end of history. A challenge to first imagine and then create a new stage of history, a new kind of humanity, a new way of living, which we call socialism.
Okay, yeah.